When you stop and think about it, archaeologists basically study stuff that people left lying around. So how can they study a city that completely disappears every year?
It is, in many ways, an archaeologist's worst nightmare.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll experience the archaeology of Burning Man. We'll also hear how at least one graduating class got a socially distant ceremony and spend an academic minute studying the humanities. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you wandered around Nevada looking for Black Rock City, most of the year you probably wouldn't find it. That's the name of the settlement built each year in the desert for the Burning Man event. Burning Man requires that participants leave no trace. And that made Dr. Carolyn White's project challenging, to say the least. Dr. White is a professor of anthropology at the University of Nevada, Reno, and her latest book is called The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. We spoke recently, and I asked what got her interested in archaeology in the first place.
Oh, gosh. I became interested in archaeology in some ways at an early age, but unlike many people, I didn't actually even know that I wanted to be an archaeologist. I was interested in material culture, and I was interested in kind of going behind the scenes in places like museums. But it wasn't until I was in college that I learned about historical archaeology, and I was really attracted to the way that historical archaeologists combined written records and material records to understand the past. And then once I went on a field school and combined that with liking being outside and finding things, that was history.
One of these days I'm going to talk to an archaeologist and they're going to say, it was Indiana Jones.
Well, you know, it wasn't Indiana Jones, but one of the things in those movies that I was quite excited about was the notebook of the father in the third series. It was quite embarrassing to admit, but no, it wasn't. It was a little off the mark for me.
So you're into archaeology, and we have the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans and Native American culture, and now Burning Man. How does that fit in there?
That's right. Well, you know, my training originally was looking at 18th and 19th century material culture to understand how people lived in the past and the kinds of things that they did on a daily basis and the material form of those past worlds, you know, basically how people lived from day to day. And when I moved from the East Coast after graduate school to Nevada and started working at the University of Nevada, I had heard about this place called Burning Man, and I decided after a summer when the dust from Burning Man was kicking up and reaching our camp that maybe I should take a look at that place as a possible spot where I could apply the methods and theories that I used to extract information from the past onto the present.
Archaeologists study things that are left behind. Isn't the motto of Burning Man, leave nothing behind?
Yes, it is in many ways an archaeologist's worst nightmare. It is the world's largest leave no trace event. So it means that when they take down the city, that nothing is left behind. But I think that is an even bigger argument for doing what I call active site archaeology, of looking at a place while people are living in it to understand how it works, how people live on a daily basis, and also with Burning Man, since it's a temporary city, we get the chance to see all phases of its life from when it's not there, to when it's built, to when it's dismantled, and when it's not there again.
You heard about Burning Man before going into this. When you got there, what were you wrong about in your preconceptions?
Well, probably about everything. I had heard about Burning Man from my brother-in-law. He had a fantastic time, but it didn't sound really like my cup of tea to be in the desert and just kind of roaming around. But I had no idea, actually, that it would be so fascinating to see this amazingly chaotic city with all of this spectacle, with giant fires and art cars roaming the streets, theme camps that looked like they came out of Blade Runner. But what was so surprising to me was less the spectacle, but more the organization that lay underneath the chaos. It was clear that this was very organized with a strong infrastructure that allowed this layer of chaos to be on top of it. And it was really that tension between the chaos and the control of the space that I was immediately attracted to. And I had no idea that it would feel that way, to be so organized.
Were there any archaeology projects that you either knew of or involved with that you could use to compare this project to?
Well, in some ways, in fact, a lot of the work that I had done as an archaeologist of looking at urban environments prepared me to study Black Rock City, because they have a lot of the same features that you see anywhere else. There are roads and streets and kind of this municipal quality. But a lot of my work has focused on domestic space and how people live in their homes. So at Burning Man, people build homes. They are called camps there. So that's one way that it's pretty similar to other archaeological sites that I've worked on, where we're looking at those same kinds of things. Where do people sleep? Where do they eat? What do they eat? What do they do in their free time? How do they interact with one another? But of course, like so many other places, when we look at Burning Man and see the kind of messiness of daily life, we know that that happens at other archaeological sites, but it can be a lot harder to see. In terms of active site archaeology, there are a few other scholars that have done similar projects that have looked at contemporary streetscapes, or there's another scholar that's looked at the Isle of Wight Music Festival. And so there's some commonality in that approach. Most people that do contemporary archaeology are looking at the very recent past, so something that happened 20 years ago. It's a bit unusual to look at a site that is currently occupied.
Year after year, you get to see these camps develop and be built. Did that give you a better understanding of maybe looking back and seeing how ancient civilizations might have been built?
Yeah, I think that it really points out a few things. One is that people today are dealing with a lot of the same restrictions and opportunities that people did in the past. They're limited to the materials that they have at hand. So you see many of the same materials being used. The house form is pretty similar in terms of the basic needs of sleeping spaces, public spaces, places to cook, those kinds of things. At the same time, we see that at Burning Man, this way that things like porta potties and sanitation really dictate a lot of decisions that people make about where to live in the city. There's a kind of premium real estate for places that are close enough, but not too close to the porta potties. And we don't, as archaeologists, tend to forget about those kinds of not so appealing components of the past that can have a huge impact. Things like how people get rid of trash. I mean, of course, as archaeologists, we often deal in other people's trash, but just thinking about how much of an impact those kinds of decisions can be on daily life.
Nobody wants the house that's next to the landfill.
No, exactly. But the latecomers, that might be all they have.
This book has dozens of photos in it. Was photography very integral in the way you studied this once the entire city was torn down?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as archaeologists, we are very persnickety about the kinds of controls that we have about studying the places that we're looking at. So whether that's taking very careful drawings of artifacts when they're in situ, or doing photography now that digital photography is pervasive. But yes, archaeology through photography is something that has become increasingly important, especially as digital means have expanded so much. So rather than in a living environment, people are moving around so quickly, you can't take a week to map someone's camp, especially when you only have a week for the entire city to be there. So it allows you to move quickly through a place and capture a lot of the life while seeing the material remains at the same time. So absolutely, a lot of this project has been reflecting on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images that I've taken.
Burning Man's been around for years and years. Is there some kind of like zoning board that can tell you how your camp can be shaped and where it can be built?
Absolutely. So one of the privileges of being a theme camp is that you can apply to Burning Man for early placement. So that means that before you get to Black Rock City, your lot has been claimed for you. So I camp with Alternative Energy Zone, which is a large village, and that is a big camp that meets a variety of requirements that they have in order to get placed. So you have to, for one thing, make sure that you are not a mooper, that you clean up after yourself.
Hold on. Mooper?
Yes. Trash is called moop at Burning Man.
Okay.
Matter out of place.
Of course it is.
After Mary Douglas, an anthropologist's idea. So all trash is called moop. And the thing that is about the worst insult is to call someone a mooper, because it's not just that you are a litter bug, but it indicates that you really don't care. So after Burning Man is over, when the inspection crew is moving through the city and doing the cleanup, if you have left a big mess behind, you might lose your privilege of being placed the next year. And so Burning Man then figures out how the city will be laid out and where the kind of municipal areas will be, where the big dance camps will be placed, which is on the outskirts of the city. And then in the middle, they place the theme camps so that they can have their prime spots. Another component of those theme camps is that they are supposed to be able to articulate what they give back to the community, since one of the principles is a gift economy. Each camp has to clearly articulate what it is that they're doing to participate and give to the city.
Still to come, our conversation with Professor Carolyn White continues with a look at some of the more interesting camps she's seen in Black Rock City. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Carolyn White, a professor of anthropology at the University of Nevada, Reno. We're talking about the archaeology project that led her to her latest book called The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. I asked her about some of the more interesting camps she's seen at the event, including one called the French Quarter.
Yes, well, the French Quarter at Burning Man is a fabulous place. This is one of the pretty spectacular theme camps. It's 6 different storefronts, complete with cast iron balcony, straight out of, you know, a dusty New Orleans, certainly. There's a bakery, a bar, a voodoo shop, as well as a bathhouse. And it's a 2-story building that's made out of plywood and steel stakes and framing. And it is far more than what you would think of as a temporary structure. It's very sturdy. And in fact, the top floor is used for a residential apartment for a couple of very lucky people.
Good grief. And some of the ones, other ones that that just struck you every year.
Well, I have to give a big shout out to Sun Tracker Camp, which was the first camp that I really started to study. The first year I was there, I was stuck in a huge dust storm, completely unprepared for the harsh realities of life on the playa. And I kind of stumbled into this camp and met Bruce, who fortunately for me had a plan drawing, a map of his camp, kind of doing the archaeologist's work even before I got there. And he shared that with me and was very excited about the project. And his camp is interesting because it has this kind of front area that converts from front porch where they have breakfast and lunch and maybe take a little nap in the shade. And then every day at 3 o'clock, it converts to a margarita bar, and it has, you know, 20, 30, 40 people there every day at 3 o'clock to have a margarita with a wind-powered blender. And it's just a fantastic gathering spot, and he does this every year. People know about it, return every year, and it really embodies the way that burners organize their camps, but also the ways that space can be used in so many different ways. And when we witness it, we can see those multiple uses that you don't necessarily imagine when you're just thinking about how people use space.
Has this project changed the way you go into a conventional archaeology project?
Absolutely, yes. I think one of the things that has brought to my attention, we've touched on a couple of those, is just the messiness of the world and trying to inject an understanding that that messiness is present at every time period. So in thinking about 19th century mining camps, for example, they also had this very rapid building and taking down and quick cyclicality that we see at Burning Man. More permanent, what we would think of as more permanent environments, also have a lot of that messiness in the ways that people use space for multiple activities. We like to think that, you know, people sleep in the bedroom, they eat in the dining room, but that's certainly not true, and probably those of us working from home for the first time can understand the multiple ways that space has to be used when in particular times. So I think it is a great lesson for all archaeologists to think about the noise and activity that you see in a place everywhere. And to think about what's missing and how that the sound and the smells and the three-dimensionality of a site is present in the past just as it is today.
Well, this is an odd year in that Burning Man has been canceled. Has that happened? Has that happened before?
No, it has never. Well, it is. It happened in 1990 when one of the first Burning Mans that was still on Baker Beach was shut down, but it wasn't canceled. It was simply moved to the playa, and the rest is history. It's happened every year since then. So this is a first, and we'll see what ends up happening to kind of create a virtual Burning Man.
Well, I want to sign into that.
Yes, absolutely. I think I don't know what the details will be so far, but I'm anxious to see what they do.
What didn't I ask you that people should know about this project?
Well, I think that when you have a contemporary place like Burning Man, we are able to really get into the kinds of vitality that humans are capable of. We see a city that's gone and reappears year after year. And one thing about Black Rock City, for all of its spectacle, for all of its massive bonfires and kind of Blade Runner look, Burning Man is also every city. And when we think about our world today, or what future archaeologists will see, we can imagine that they're going to try to understand the vitality, messiness, and noise, and the way that people move around the world, just as I'm trying to understand Burning Man today. And I think that active site archaeology in general exposes a past that is messier, much more complicated, and much more richly textured than we have allowed ourselves to imagine.
Yeah, I imagine that the archaeologists of 300 years from now are going to have an easier time studying the New York of 2020 than you're having studying, say, ancient Athens of 2020 BC.
Well, maybe. I think people think that we will be able to just read what daily life was like, but I dare you to even try to understand some of what daily life was like 15 years ago and try to read the documents or those old computer disks that we had. So I think it'll be I think it's always challenging to try to envision the world of the past no matter what. And that's part of the joy of archaeology, is putting those pieces together.
Dr. Carolyn White is a professor of anthropology at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her latest book is called The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. The United States Air Force Academy held its commencement on April 18th in a greatly scaled-back ceremony. No friends or family were allowed to attend. They had to watch online. Still, the event retained some of its traditions and graduated its first cadets into the newly established Space Force. Dan Boyce of the American Homefront Project reports from Colorado Springs.
The ceremony's live stream on YouTube begins with this odd and almost haunting juxtaposition. Dramatic music, flashy graphics combined with video of previous year's graduations, and then cut to a live feed of an empty podium looking out on the Academy's empty parade field. Well, empty except for a small media box and about 1,000 chairs. Chairs arranged in a socially distant grid, each precisely 8 feet from each other.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence.
Vice President Pence had planned on providing a video commencement address for the graduating cadets, yet here he is, walking solo across the parade grounds toward the stage and the podium. From both sides of the field come the 967 cadets in crisp blue and white uniforms, most wearing thick gold sashes around their waist, though a few, 86 actually, wearing silver sashes. The Space Force cadets, including Ashley Nimmo.
All lined up side by side, front to back, marching in.
Still 8 feet from one another. Nimmo says it's bittersweet, the pandemic keeping their families away and prompting the Academy to graduate the cadets 6 weeks ahead of schedule.
But we're excited that we're one of the few colleges in the nation to be getting an actual physical graduation, and we're ready to move on to the next chapter of our lives.
Speaking to the graduates at the podium, the nation's first chief of space operations, General John Raymond.
You will lay the foundation of service that is innovative and can go fast in order to stay ahead of a significant and growing threat.
He's talking about the threat in space from other world powers like Russia and China. And innovation is exactly where another Space Force cadet wants to focus. Van Woolman describes the new branch as the world's largest startup company. And he's been trying to find positives in enduring a pandemic during his chaotic last semester.
Disruptive change and uncertain situations is definitely something that I'm very fond of and love kind of digging into.
And as America knows, you completed one of the most challenging semesters in the histories of the Air Force Academy.
Vice President Mike Pence.
And we rightly honor each and every one of you, those who are here and those who are not.
His words come after a month where two seniors died in the span of 3 days, suspected suicides. At the time, seniors had been spaced out through the dorm rooms and largely confined there. Tough physical conditioning waited as punishment for those violating the social distancing restrictions. Those restrictions were eased after the two deaths, and the early graduation was announced shortly after.
Will you please raise your right hand
And after I read
the cadets stand from the spaced out grid of chairs and take their oath.
Do each of you, having been a
The U.S. Naval Academy has canceled graduation ceremonies this year, though President Trump has said he will speak at the commencement for West Point Military Academy in June.
Class of 2020, dismissed!
Now second lieutenants, the Air and Space Force cadets throw their white hats upward as the Thunderbirds jet squadron tears across the overcast skies. Most of the graduates celebrate in place, maintaining proper social distancing, though a few cannot help but embrace. In Colorado Springs, I'm Dan Boyce.
Those non-technical skills you learned in college may be worth more than you thought. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The humanities and soft skills might be more important than ever. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lori Grobman, professor of English and Women's Studies at Penn State University, says these skills will become more important for businesses in our changing world.
Despite constant rhetoric about the uselessness of the humanities, I and my colleague, E. Michelle Ramsey, have found that across business and industry, the humanities are increasingly recognized as technology's invisible partner. We argue that the humanities are technology's necessary partner. Rapid change across all economic sectors and in virtually all workplaces, mass amounts of information needing to be interpreted wisely and ethically, the advantages but also threats of automation, and the negative costs of cultural misunderstanding all demand critical and creative thinkers and problem solvers who are flexible and adaptable. These and other skills, typically labeled soft skills, but what we call core skills, are more important for college graduates than ever before, and they are promoted through coursework in the humanities. That's why an array of jobs and career opportunities are available to humanities graduates across all sectors of the economy. The Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce found that in 2018, the average salary for humanities and business majors was nearly equal. Moreover, ethical questions arising from emerging technologies demand humanistic thinking. So do complex and ever-evolving wicked problems that resist easy solutions. Because these issues are simultaneously technical and human, a 2018 report by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine calls for integrating the arts, humanities, and STEM in higher education.
That was Lori Grobman of Penn State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.